This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. After Shirley Jackson's short story, The Lottery, was published in The New Yorker nearly 70 years ago, readers flooded the magazine with letters. Many threatened to cancel their subscriptions. Others thought Jackson had witnessed a real stoning ritual and demanded an explanation. Still others wrote to Jackson wanting to know where they could watch the annual lottery for themselves. That was 1948. For decades, the story has since raised chilling questions about tradition and conformity in anthologies in middle school English classes. Now, 100 years after Jackson's birth, comes a new telling of the story, a graphic novel of the lottery by her grandson, Miles Hyman. Miles Hyman, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Miles, your grandmother died quite suddenly when you were very young. Do you remember her at all?
I have one very sort of vague memory of her. I was only three when she passed away, and I have this image of her sitting in the kitchen preparing dinner, having a glass of bourbon and enjoying the evening. It was a very sort of fleeting image, one of those sort of early childhood impressions that one holds on to.
Yeah, well, now your book is being released at the centennial of her birth. But you have adapted other literary classics, something of the Black Dahlia, among others, but never quite taken the lottery on until now. Why not?
You know, it was the sort of project that took some time. I really wanted to make sure that the time was right. There were also some technical sort of hesitations on my end. I for a while, figured that an illustrated version would be the way to go, be a way to sort of preserve the original text. But as I started doing more and more graphic novels, it seemed to me that that was really the way to go at it, that it was going to allow me to create a much more intimate rapport between the reader and the story. And it's the sort of chilling tale that really gains in impact from that sort of retelling in a graphic form.
Yeah, there's a lot of wordless panels. You know, you set up the scene a little bit earlier than the story does. We get these images of a village at night, you know, this box retrieved from a storeroom. And then day breaks, just like the story at its source. There's still something eerie, you know, about these images of sheds and cornfields lurking under these scenes. So how did you approach that as a kind of visual narrative?
You know, that first scene actually came from a sentence in the original story, and I kept sort of rereading that sentence and thinking that there was something there that was going to allow me to sort of tell some important parts of the story visually. I created that first scene so that the reader has all of the information she or he needs going forward to understand the basic tools that are going to be in play, the black box, the pieces of paper, and that that we know right from the outset that there is this black dot on one of the pieces of paper that's obviously going to become a major element of the story as we go forward. And telling that scene, creating that scene, became a way to give the reader all that information in, you know, 10 short pages.
Well, your grandmother was known for a very economical, restrained prose, especially in this story, which many people know her for. Now, there are many silent panels that put, of course, a different weight on the text that you do choose to include. You know, a little bit the flowers, this dialogue, this very matter-of-fact, hi, Steve. Hi, Joe. You know,
yes,
kind of
sure.
Thing. So how did you decide which text to include?
Well, I included all of the actual dialogue from the original story. And some of the narrative sequences I converted into dialogue. Dialogue is obviously far more effective in a graphic novel form than a sort of omniscient narrative. It tends to be a much more effective way of telling the story. So I did as much sort of conversion into visual form as I could. But I was very faithful to the story beyond those first scenes, which are there to replace that omniscient narrative. My drawings, one of the real goals I set up for myself doing these drawings was to find a visual language that would be as close as possible to her written language, And by that I mean when there are details, they're ambiguous. Many of the faces are seen from quite close, or we see the crowd from far away. The details and the atmosphere is there, but sometimes we're still just a little bit short of understanding exactly what is going on. And it was so important to keep that tension and to keep that ambiguity open during the entire first phase of the story, so that at the end, when we do start to understand what is actually happening, it seems to come out of nowhere.
Well, then these characters' faces, they look very, you know, hard under the June sun. And I, looking at them, maybe just historically thought of those, you know, Dorothy Lange's photographs of the Dust Bowl migrants, for example. Who did you use as models or images for those?
Oh, I used all sorts of images. I mean, many of them are just invented, but often I did spend a lot of time looking at just old photographs of the 30s, 40s, and 50s, photographs taken around America, not only in the Dust Bowl era. But no, my goal was to have these faces represent a sort of a mass of humanity, in a sense. Mm-hmm. I did. If you think about it, there are 300 characters. Or I should say 300 villagers in this village, but really only about 12 that actually do anything, 12 that have any speaking parts, I would say. And the rest of them are really there just to sort of relay the tension and the anguish of what's building between them. As we hear the voices being called, sometimes you'll see people coming up, and sometimes there will be a portrait of a family. Mm-hmm. I've done quite a few different things so that we're always coming at the scene from a different angle. And it was this very long scene of names being called. It was essential to kind of find a graphic solution to make it dynamic and to make it constantly new to the reader's eye.
This is a very interesting time to be revisiting this novel. I mean, you live in Paris mostly, you know, another city that has been racked by extremist violence. In Europe, of course, this rise of popular nationalist movements, not just in Europe, but all over. So what about readers maybe discovering this story for the first time? What are they going to see?
Well, you know, it's funny. Two things. Yes, you're right that I did do many of these sketches during the whole period of the Paris attacks. I was also listening to news coverage of the U.S. elections. a lot of things came into play and made me realize the story remains as pertinent today as it was in 1948 in a lot of ways. Notably, the way the subject of the story tends to be about fear and about how fear changes the public discourse, and how in many ways fear allows old ideas to remain in place well beyond their due date, I would say. But yes, I would say that readers here in France, and many of whom are reading the story for the first time because it was translated years ago, but in a very bad translation, so it's not very well known, certainly not as well as in the United States, and many of them have been as shocked as the readers in the 40s were. I've had many people come up to me and ask whether it was based on real events. Some people have been really, really shocked and, I would say, almost put off by the story in ways that made me think of the letters that my grandmother received after the publication in The New Yorker in 1948.
Well, Miles Hyman, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate being invited.
Miles Hyman, he's grandson of Shirley Jackson, an author and artist behind the authorized graphic adaptation of Shirley Jackson's The Lottery. You can find more about Miles' new adaptation at wordofmouthradio.org.